Hello, welcome to the Do Lectures podcast with me, Gav Thompson. Today on ... we talk to Chris Hallinger. Chris was 23 when she was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. She didn't realise she had cancer, she didn't know she could get cancer, and frankly, she was diagnosed late. The doctors should have spotted it earlier. Chris went on to have an unbelievable rollercoaster ride with cancer, but she also set up a charity called Copperfeel, which has helped educate men and women to check their breasts early, and in doing so, has actually saved thousands of people's lives. She went on to win a Pride of Britain award. She is truly inspirational, and I urge you to listen to this one. It has the best of the Do Lectures, but it also has a healthy dose of being amazing despite. So please sit back, grab a coffee, put your feet up and listen to Chris Hallinger's ... So welcome to your ... podcast, Chris Hallinger.
Hi, great to be here.
Very, very, very pleased to have you. So Chris, you did a Do Lecture in 2018 and you famously, really, in the world of Do Lectures, came up with one of my favourite first lines of a Do Lecture, where you said that you peed yourself a little bit when you got the email asking you to be on the Do Lectures. Tell us why you nearly peed yourself when you got the email from the Do Lectures.
I just felt so honoured. So I was so excited to be there. I hadn't ever been before, but I'd heard so much about it. It's almost like this sort of secret venue at Glastonbury that you hear about, but you can never reach yourself. Obviously, I could have just bought a ticket, but it felt almost like this unreachable thing. And then to be invited to not only come, but obviously speak and share my thoughts in a space that I have so much respect for was just really exciting. I have lots of friends who have worked there or have presented there, and it just seemed like this incredible thing. And I mean, I was proven right. Like, it was amazing from start to finish. Like, you just come away with so much inspiration and motivation and creativity. You're just like flooded with it for the weekend that you come away feeling like so exhilarated.
Funny, isn't it? Because it's really hard to explain. And
yes,
I was talking to Kasim about this a few weeks ago. We're both lucky enough, Kasim and I, to have been to TED, big global TED, many, many times, like 5 or 6 times. I maintain this, that I think the Do Lectures are more special experience than going to TED, and for me, is a life-changing experience.
Mm.
So let's sort of hear your story up until the Do Lecture in 2018. We'll obviously talk about it, because I have got a little bit of similar experience, albeit nothing like as dramatic as yours. And then, yeah, let's talk about the future and where you are. But yeah, you've had an amazing life. Tell us about it.
In a nutshell, I mean, we could be here all day and that's fine. But I guess, you know, the story that I shared at Do was the perspective of someone, me, who has been living with breast cancer for quite some time. So I was diagnosed in 2009 when I was 23. And that came as a very late diagnosis because for too long I've been told that it wasn't anything to worry about and I was ignoring symptoms. And then by the time it was found, it was stage 4, as others might know it, as advanced cancer or metastatic cancer or secondary breast cancer. And it meant that it was incurable but treatable for as long as possible. And now, 12 years on, I'm still here, surviving just about. But in that time, I've set up a charity called Copperfeel, which educates young people about breast cancer. You know, the importance of getting to know their boobs, pecs, chest, and starting a good relationship with their body and their health. Something that I completely didn't do, and something that I soon realised lots of young people weren't doing. And I thought, well, something had to be done about that. Something, you know, we had to bring it into their consciousness a little bit more, not to scare them, but to educate them and make them feel empowered about their own health.
I mean, let me just quickly share my little story because it's relevant. But again, there's a thing about cancer. When you meet other cancer patients, and we're both cancer patients, survivors, recoverers, whatever, I think I'm probably a bit further down the line than Chris is, sadly. But there is a thing you definitely quickly kind of compare and contrast, and that it's a bit like Top Trumps. I've got a kind of Ford Fiesta, which is i.e. low-level car top trumps of cancer, whereas I think Chris has got the, you know, is in, she is kind of in the top trump department. But we do share something in common, which is both of our cancers were not diagnosed by professionals. I had tongue cancer. I went to see my dentist to get a clean bill of health. And so she actually inspected my mouth, didn't see it, didn't spot it, which was crazy because it was there and it was quite far gone. And then only when I went to my new dentist, literally 2 weeks later, he spotted it, it was there. And I, a bit like you, Chris, I kind of ignored it. I didn't assume how I could ever have had tongue cancer age 37 and ignored it. Finally, it was my dentist, the new dentist, that chased it and got me in front of a consultant. And I was diagnosed with cancer and then went through all the treatment, of which was nothing as horrific as yours. But I guess there are some similarities of that, not having it diagnosed and also just not thinking that how could we as young, healthy people possibly have cancer? How did it come about that yours wasn't diagnosed for such a long time?
You know, I've heard many stories like yours since mine. And I think that comes from thinking that we don't have to take these things into our own hands, that we can kind of heavily rely on the specialists and the experts to tell us the answers and to not disagree with them, because why would we know our bodies better than them? Which is certainly the attitude that I had when I first went to the doctor. I was desperate to hear that I was fine. I didn't want them to tell me that I had to have further, be referred and have further tests, especially because I was just trying to get my life. I was trying to start things in my life. I was 23 and I'd just about to head to Beijing and do a job over there. And I didn't want someone to say, no, you can't go. You have to have these tests. So I was very happy to hear that it was nothing to worry about and that I could go on my jolly way, which is what I did. But it was only when my mum insisted that I should probably go back and insist on a referral because the symptoms weren't going away. The pain was so bad, I couldn't lie on my front at night. You know, by this point, I had very horrendous symptoms. I'm so glad that I listened to her and that she was such a bolshy mother.
Yeah, no, good on you. So have you had the conversation with the original doctor or doctors that didn't spot it? Because again, one of the things that happened to me, my dentist that did spot it, he wrote a very strongly worded letter to the dentist that didn't spot it going, you should know you missed something that you shouldn't have done. And, you know, back to, we'll talk about this later, about teachable moments and black box thinking and how actually the medical profession need to learn from each other. And he wrote a letter to her, which apparently she replied to him, was very grateful that he'd written that and was very shocked that she'd missed it and all that good stuff. Have you spoken to your doctors that did miss it? Have they learnt from this experience?
All I can hope is that they have. I think, given that my story actually, you know, went all over the local paper. And
it went a bit further than that, Chris, if I'm honest.
Yeah, well, at the start, though, I'd like, you know, it was very much a local thing. And because of what I was doing with the charity, it was quite newsworthy. I did see this person again, the very first GP that I went to, because I went to ask for some sleeping pills just after I was diagnosed, because I realised that nothing helped me to sleep, you know, as my mind was all over the place. And also it gave me an opportunity to sit opposite her and kind of see whether she would apologise and acknowledge that she could have done something sooner. But she didn't. You know, I immediately switched GPs, went to a different practice entirely. I investigated whether there was any way that we could sue or, you know, whatever.
So a malpractice,
Yeah, it's very hard to prove negligence. You can't prove that when my cancer spread, etc. So, and also I soon realised that that really wasn't the track I wanted to go down, like getting someone struck off when I could actually educate a whole group of people that didn't yet know about breast cancer seemed to me much more practical and positive way of dealing with it. And I just hope that with her maybe hearing about what I was doing with the charity and the way I shared and shared and shared the story of my misdiagnosis would be a constant reminder to never do that again and to start listening to her younger patients and to sometimes be allowed to say, I don't know, but I'm going to find out for sure. Like, I don't need doctors to have all the answers, but I do need them to care and to really try and get to the bottom of something together, even if that's teamwork. They don't have to own the whole thing. But she could have referred me from the start, she didn't. That's something that she has to live with now.
No, she does. And look, I mean, one of the things I think is interesting about what people like you and I have been through is the acknowledgement that doctors make mistakes, that doctors have good days and bad days. They may be distracted. They may come in with a hangover. They may have just had a fight with their partner. And, you know, things do go wrong. And if they go very, very badly wrong, people die. And one of the things about the medical profession, still, I don't think they're very good at owning up to their mistakes and they're not very good at learning from them. certainly not publicly. There is a very interesting book, we talked about this, by Matthew Syed, called Black Box Thinking, where he compares the attitude of medical professions when things go wrong to the attitude of the airline industry when things go wrong. So when a pilot makes a mistake and they have a crash and people die, there's huge investigation, there's huge, it's public, there's a thing called the black box that records it all, and then things get published and laws get changed and training modules get changed and good things happen. You know, planes get redesigned. There is very little comparison with the medical industry where it gets brushed under the carpet, people get embarrassed. Even now, people like you and I are slightly reluctant to call doctors out on it, I think. But if my ex-cancer consultant is now works in, he's a kind of consultant who specialises in helping patients bring malpractice suits. That's what he's now doing because he realised that there's so much of it out there and, mm-hmm. and doctors need to learn and be accountable. So tell us what then happened, because you were in treatment, obviously quite mm-hmm. unpleasant, aggressive cancer treatment, but at the same time you launched the charity. How did that come about?
Yeah, I was having chemotherapy. I had to start that early on to try and shrink the tumour in my breast. I was living at home with mum and spending a lot of time either feeling unwell or not feeling unwell, but having very little else to do or think about than cancer because I didn't have a job anymore. I was just like, had a lot of time on my hands, I suppose, if you can call it that, and just couldn't get this sort of niggle out of my head how baffling it was that I didn't know I could get breast cancer at 23 and how little education there is out there for young people. So it was really just I went on a one-woman mission of doing all this research to find out why that was and who was actually educating anyone about breast cancer, and obviously soon realising that it was very much targeted at older women who are more likely to get it but could still do with early education. Started talking to lots and lots of people and then decided we should take the message out to young people at a festival, which is where we started talking to people about boobs, and we haven't really stopped for 12 years.
And you were still in treatment, chemo, but you were at the festival. Tell us about the festival, what happened?
Yeah, so it was this festival called Beach Break Live, which was a student-only festival. So I don't think there's a harder group of people to reach than students who have clocked off from school and education, who are on their summer break and are there to have nothing but fun. And I thought if we could get through to them, then surely we're on to a winner. And obviously we didn't know what we were doing. We had no idea how we would broach the subject with them. All I said to my friends who were going is, would you mind standing in this gazebo with me and talk to people about boobs? And they said, absolutely, that's fine. It wasn't until my sister and I were face painting each other that someone came over and said, how much is a face painting? Because they assumed we were a face painting stall. And that's when we realised if we could face paint people, then we had a captive person in front of us who we could start a conversation about boobs with. And that's what we continued to do. And at the same time, started to fundraise because we'd say, hey, fancy chucking some money in this bucket so we can become a charity, an actual registered charity. But yeah, it was a success. It was one of those sort of trial and error, see what sticks. And it began in a field and people left our tent thinking, oh, that's not what I was expecting to hear. But equally, I'm not scared off by that. Like, that was fine. And I was there, I had no hair, but I was there. I don't know if it was this renewed energy, this buzz of the passion that I was, you know, was being fueled in my belly that really helped me to get through those days, or if I genuinely was feeling okay at that time and the chemo wasn't ravaging my cells of that day or whatever. But I genuinely felt so vibrant and so happy to be there and start this new thing that they saw someone, yes, she had no hair, but no, it wasn't stopping her from doing anything. Like, you know, having no hair is not synonymous with having a miserable life. I could share my story and educate them about my lack of awareness and what that led to and how I shouldn't now need treatment for the rest of my life. Like, this should be a blip. This should be just something that I can get over and carry on with my life. And, you know, I could see in their eyes that that's what they want.
Yeah.
If someone is threatening or kind of challenging them on their future, of course they're going to think about it. Like, they are about to start their life, really, after university and decide what they want to do. And if someone's saying, well, what would you do if you got cancer? Like, what? How would that affect your life? And it's to get them thinking about it, but not in a scary way, but as like just a, oh, this isn't something that I need to be worried about, because the chances of me getting it are slim at this age. But at some point in my life, I'm going to be affected by cancer. How the way I deal with it is going to be helped so much if I acknowledge that now and acknowledge my health now and empower myself now, than being struck down by it almost at a later stage. They left empowered is what I hope and feel from that event. And it gave us this real motivation, G'd us up to keep doing that and registered to become a charity. So we, you know, were a bit more credible when we were doing these approaches and people would take us slightly more seriously. And now we still exist, you know, we've got through a pant.
So the name Copperfield, how did that come about?
Well, obviously the action to Copperfield, to almost grope yourself. I mean, at the time, you could argue that it was maybe a bit of a derogatory term, might be seen as some unsolicited groping. I mean, it can be seen that way, but we obviously tried to make it not that way. And, you know, we wanted something cheeky and a bit different, something with cut through. And I really love it when people say, I love that your name does what it says on the tin. Like, so obviously, you know, our message is our name. If someone says, what does Copper feel like? You kind of go, well, what do you think it is? So I like that it was simple. Yeah, it was just a term that was quite, I guess, fresh in my mind. I'd just come back from Beijing and I would be on the commuter trains in the morning where they're literally cramming you on from the, there's literally staff on the platforms cramming you onto the underground. And then, you know, I would joke with my friend, even though it's not that funny, that someone could be intentionally or unintentionally copping a feel. So I guess maybe that phrase was fresh in my mind. I came home and I just happened to suggest it to my friends who were kind of helping me develop Copperfield at the time. And they all thought it was brilliant.
It is a genius name, actually, because you're right. It does exactly what it says on the tin. If you know nothing else, it tells you you should be checking your breasts, right?
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
Well, it is. Trust me, I'm a marketing guy. Yeah. It's a piece of genius branding. And what is your message with Copperfield?
So we are an education charity. So ultimately, we have three main things that we want to get across to people: that they are aware that they need to check their boobs, that they're aware of the signs and symptoms, you know, signs and symptoms of breast cancer, so things to be looking out for when they're checking their boobs or pecs or chest, and to feel empowered and confident to go and speak to a GP about it. Because it's one thing to check yourself and start that habit, but it's another to then, when something does crop up, to have the confidence to say, hey, I've noticed something and this is how long it's been there and I feel this isn't normal for me. You need to do something about it. You know, that takes balls to do that. And I guess we're trying to empower people to do that and make them feel like they are their own best advocate. They have the right to say, this doesn't feel right for me. Basically say all the things that I didn't the day I went to the GP. And yeah, it's brilliant. It's a simple message. It's a simple thing that you can do.
You are listening to the Do Lectures .. podcast with Gav Thompson.
I mean, one of the crazy things about your story, you know, you went off and won a Pride of Britain award. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was also all in the same year. So throughout the summer, I'd been doing some, I guess, I was just literally sharing my story wherever I could. And I did the TV ad for Cancer Research UK. And it was them who put me forward for this award, as well as my mum. Bizarrely, I won. I won a recognition award at the Pride of Britain Awards. And it felt very weird to be winning something. In a way, I couldn't really understand it. It was amazing and I felt incredible and honoured and so happy to be recognised for the work that I was doing, but still felt a little bit like a fraud because I hadn't actually achieved anything yet. I think, you know, when you set out to do something that has a wishy-washy title such as awareness, I have every right to challenge that person who's doing the awareness and say, well, what impact are you having? And if anything, I'm quite glad when people do challenge us on that and say, well, how can you prove that what you're doing is working? And I think for me, it's not enough sometimes to just say that it is. Yeah, you know, I want evidence. Proof, yeah. And, you know, charities are using goodwill and I wanted to make sure that that goodwill was going to good use. And so when I was stood on that stage of receiving this award from the Spice Girls, I couldn't help but think, well, this is great, amazing, and excellent advertising for Copperfield, and also very motivating to really show that this is working. Because at this point, I mean, we weren't even a registered charity yet at this point. So we'd been to two festivals that summer. I'd started a blog about my story. I mean, who hasn't? And, you know, I started a voice within the community, like the health space around breast cancer and a young person and terminal illness and living with cancer that was quite new at the time. And it had a lot of cut through. And the fact that I had a twin sister meant that it was very media worthy. You know, my story was everywhere. And it was brilliant in terms of that's what you need when you're starting a campaign. It was brilliant. But I really felt like I had something to prove after I won that award. And it's good. You know, I felt really motivated and good.
Well, you did. Well, you have. And where is Copperfield today? I mean, it has been an amazing success. Bring us up to date, you know, with the Copperfield kind of ..
So Copperfield survived a pandemic, which is amazing, when so many charities didn't. We had to furlough people, obviously, but everyone's back and we're recruiting again. Like, so there's now 20 staff at Copperfield, which blows my mind. And we have managed to get our education, like, become statutory within schools as part of the PSHE curriculum. We have, you know, our BooBets doing talks up and down the country all the time. We have some very ambitious marketing plan, like a campaign plans for this summer. We always do an annual campaign that we take into any sort of media space that we can, but we do a lot of TV and cinema advertising. Yeah, we have some really cool stuff, and we actually recently launched something called the Self Checkout, which is a digital tool that basically becomes your robot friend who helps talk you through how to check yourself. Like, no stone is left unturned. It helps you identify what you want to call your boobs, you know, because we all identify. I call my boobs boobs, even though I don't have any now. But, you know, we need to get to a place of where someone feels totally comfortable to talk about their boobs, their chest, their pecs, and touch them and get to know them. And this tool that we have on our website helps to do that, and ultimately gets to a point where someone is left feeling like, okay, my next step is to go speak to a professional about it or to keep an eye on it, and hopefully left feeling like, okay, I know what I need to do next, and make them feel a lot less scared about it. Because I either feel like what happened before Copperfield came along is you either Google something and self-diagnose yourself, or you go to a GP. So we're bridging the gap between the two, like, okay, so here's some really important information, and you will be guided through a real easy tool to know how to do it properly and know what you're looking for, and advice on what to expect if you go call your GP, if that's your next step, and to not be left feeling like, well, what if this or what if that, and all these questions unanswered. So we want to make sure that when someone does book an appointment for a GP, they know exactly what to expect and what the outcome could be. There's no guessing anymore.
No, I love it. It's really simple. It's really clear. It's really empowering. It's really helpful. And I do think the tone is actually what makes it cut through, is that cancer's a freaking serious business, as we both know. But actually, you know, if you want to cut through from a brand awareness point of view, having something that's, particularly with younger women, younger men, you know, I think it's really neat. I love the thing you've managed to do to get the Copperfield sort of thing inside some of the bra manufacturers. How did that come about? That's very, very cool. Actually, tell everyone what it is, because I know what it is, but they...
Yeah, so, well, we started a campaign called the Bra Hijack, in which we were asking bra manufacturers to add a tiny little ribbon label with the care instructions that simply just reminds people to check their boobs, because it's a timely point in someone's life to do it. You know, someone is undressing or dressing, they're naked anyway, why not have a little check of your boobs while you're doing it? You know, people need these prompts. They can't just be relied upon to remember out of nowhere. We have busy lives. So I guess our aim was to integrate ourselves into people's day-to-day existence. So that's why we have shower stickers that people put up in their showers that have the signs and symptoms on. We have our text reminder service, which will send you a little prompt every month to check. So we're just trying to remove any excuse not to check yourself.
Which bras have the labels in?
A lot of the high street ones, like F&F and Tesco, Next, then some online, more niche indie brands as well.
I want to talk about your .. because, you know, your story has evolved since 2018, both in relationship to Copperfield, the charity. You're about to bring out a book, which I definitely want to talk about. But I also, you know, want to talk about your cancer journey because that's ongoing. So sort of three big questions. Let's start with Copperfield. You've stepped back from being CEO, I think.
Yeah, so actually when I did the Do lectures, I'd already stepped away as CEO. So I was already in this new, well, trying to find my feet in this new role as ambassador and doing some projects, still having my fingers in a few pies at Copperfield. And I guess since then I have found my feet even better in terms of like who I still am to the charity and how that works in relation to my relationship with the team and all the decision making that's going on there, because essentially I'm not that person anymore. I don't manage people anymore. I don't do the next big thing decision making, but I am still involved with what is happening there. I am still in touch with all the team. I do regular check-ins with our CEO and I like having an overview, but I don't know the details and I don't want to know the details. I don't need to know the granular stuff, the day-to-day stuff, but I get excited about all the new things that they're working on. And I want to help if there's something truly, if there's a crisis, you know, I want to be there for them, but without the constant pressure that I have to be at the helm, which is what I was for 6 years. So this feels a much more doable space and allows me to do other things in my life and not think about cancer every single moment of the day.
And tell us about your personal cancer journey. Where are we with that?
So 2018 was one of the hardest years of my life, and I don't think I really portrayed that.
I don't think you did. I think some of our listeners will listen to this. They'll go back and watch our Do Lecture and they'll go, is that the same person? Because in 2018, you were full of beans. I mean, you were bouncing around. You were making jokes.
Do-lecture spirit.
I mean, it's really interesting because I was like, wow. You know, I mean, she's amazing. Yeah. I mean, she's taken all this horror and misery and she's overflown with love and energy. And good on you, by the way.
Well, it's a mask that I wear lightly, you know. It's something that I can easily take off and I'm not ashamed to take off, like this positivity, this like I'm getting on with my life, I can get on with this shit. Like, I am okay most of the time. When I was at the Do Lectures, I was well. I was feeling well. I was, I think at the time, suffering from mouth ulcers from the treatments that I was on. But again, you know, maybe the icy cold coffee that I was served by Extract Coffee that really helped. Or, you know, I don't know. But it's the adrenaline that gets you through when you do talks. But basically in 2018, I discovered that I had a shitload of brain tumours that needed treating. So I was doing the talk in summer, and earlier that year I'd had a few treated. And I think shortly after the Do Lectures, I discovered more. And so I had more treatment, to very targeted radiotherapy treatment to the brain tumours. And then later that year, I had to have more. So in total, in 2018, I had 57 brain tumours treated.
Oh, my God.
And they were tiny.
That's a lot of
tiny. And I had them treated with really targeted, amazing gamma knife radiotherapy, which meant that they were treating the cancer but, you know, keeping the rest of my brain safe. But we realised later that year that the current treatment I was taking wasn't halting any new growth and that I needed a new systemic treatment, which meant that we could stop any new cancer from growing. And that's when I changed to an all chemotherapy called capecitabine, which is what I'm on at the moment still. By the end of 2018, we had to switch things up. My liver cancer was progressing quite a lot. I had a tumour that was 8 centimetres in my liver. And I think I got to a stage where I was starting to get quite poorly and things had to change. And luckily, I had an amazing medical team who supported that change and made sure that things changed quickly. And then 2019, early 2019, we realised that the drug was working. And I since then, touch wood, haven't had any new brain tumours, thankfully. I mean, I have a scan coming up soon, so who knows what's next. But at the moment, things are good and stable. But what has come up most recently is a new cancer on an adrenal gland. I mean, I knew nothing about adrenal glands before this, but they're these little glands that sit on your kidneys. You have two of them, and my breast cancer decided to spread to one of them. But that got whipped out. That's been taken away, inspected under a lab, done something with. Maybe it's an incinerator now. I don't know. But anyway, it's gone.
Good riddance.
So it's an ongoing thing, as I guess everyone would expect me to say, given that when I was talking at the Do Lectures, I was probably saying the same thing. Like, it's surprise, it hasn't gone away. Like, it's not suddenly, like, I can't tell you. Sadly can't tell you that it's now cured, because that was never an option for me. It's never really going to go away. But my hope is that the longer I'm here, the more treatments they'll find to keep me here.
I mean, at some point, it was quote-unquote terminal, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it's if you think about it, like, terminal means that there comes an end to my life, but then yours is too.
Yeah, no, I know. So, but in the world of
you were pretty
cancer much, doctors, did they not, was there not one?
Yeah, but no one's ever said
never
that.
Said that.
No one's ever said that term. No, and I just don't think it's that useful, really. I mean, what does that tell you? Yes, I'm going to die of breast cancer, but thanks, I don't need that term to know that.
It is, the funny thing is, when you get into it, as you have, and as I did a little bit, it's a numbers game. Of 100 people that had what you've got, 98% of them died within X years. But it's still only retrospective stats. It's actually kind of irrelevant to you, frankly. You could be that anomaly, or frankly, medical science improves, or, as you know, lots of things can happen. And I totally admire and respect your attitude to it, which is, yes, thanks for the stats, but I'm on my journey, and I've got my doctors, and I've got my however you deal with having cancer, and I'm lost for words, really. I think your bravery and honesty is inspiring. The fact that you can still be so positive, upbeat, happy, smiley, bouncy is amazing, and it's a freaking inspiration to cancer sufferers out there, both current and future, frankly, and past. So good on you. But how do you do it? I used to think about my daughter a lot, you know, who was 2 at the time, and I just used to really channel all the negativity away and just focus on her as a kind of force of love and...
Right.
What is that thing you had?
I basically had a crumbling spine after they discovered there was a tumour on it for a couple of years, and then the radiotherapy that I had caused the spine to get really weak. So the treatment was brilliant. It killed the cancer, but then it also killed the strength of my lower spine. So it partially collapsed, and to strengthen it back up again, they had to inject cement into my lumbar spine. And they do that with you being awake, and they basically drill these 4 holes into your spine through which they inject the cement. And yeah, you have to be awake because there's a nurse constantly asking you if you could still feel your feet, and they're not paralysing you.
Right.
So it's like, I think I definitely have PTSD.
That sounds horrific.
So, you know, I'm not going through that today. Today is a good day. Today the sun's shining. Today I might get to go in the sea. So if you asked me on a day where I was feeling unwell, and it was a day when that was bleak because I had pain or something that was reminding me of my predicament, then maybe I wouldn't come across as so happy and bouncy, whatever. But I do have those days. Like, trust me, I have those days. But today I'm not. So you're getting me on a good day.
There's a funny, irony is not quite the right word, but there is a funny sort of path to your story, which is you've had and continue to have some quite challenging medical conditions. I mean, they're horrific, frankly. But at the same time, you now find yourself having helped tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of women in a way that you maybe wouldn't have done in your normal course of life. And you've set up this charity, and you've won a Pride of Britain Award. You are an inspiration to many, many people, including me, for one. How do you kind of sometimes think through that kind of, had a shitty, really shitty experience with cancer that's ongoing, but actually it has helped me be an amazing human being? That's a weird contrast and conflict.
Yeah, it is. And not to be like classic book plug here, but so when last year I had to write my book, and it was obviously during a time where we were all stuck in our homes, and probably a good time to be writing. And in this book, I wanted to really show what it was like living with cancer, how to deal with it, etc., etc. I even called it How to Glitter It Hurt, because I was like, this is how I've done it. It might be useful for you. But then in writing it, it was like therapy, because it was finally a point in which I was re-examining just how I've managed to get to this point in my life. I was re-examining how I dealt with it so quickly. And I think it was a coping mechanism, this strategy of like, shit, this is bad. What do I do about it? Start a charity. I never gave myself any breathing space to really consider what was happening to me. I'd just been through a horrible relationship. It's almost like I was waiting for something awful to happen to gain some new perspective on life. Not that it should never take cancer for that to happen. And also at 23, I was totally allowed to be a bit miserable and be wondering what to do with my life. Like, which, there's not many early 20-year-olds who know exactly how their life's going to shape out. But it was really getting me down. And so cancer came into my life when maybe I just needed this, like, beacon, this, like, purpose. And I took it with both hands and I turned it into something brilliant that does, yes, save lives. And I cannot tell you who I would have been without it. I changed the book from How to Glitter a Turd to Glittering a Turd because I decided that this wasn't a story to help others. This was a story to help me get to really understand how and why I'm still alive today. And it's like there were no guarantees. There was no hard scientific evidence to that stuff. But I believe in purpose. I believe in the power of connecting to why you want to still be alive. I mean, I'm sure every cancer patient would agree with that too. Like, obviously you had your daughter to focus on, and it's those strong reasons for existing that slapped me around the face so many times with all the amazing things that I've got to achieve and do, that I think has absolutely ensured that my cells and every inch of my body knows that we've got to stick around. And I know that that's not sustainable, and I know that that's not necessarily forever, but it's certainly sustaining me for now, and I hope for a long time, but under no illusion that this is a shit predicament and that cancer is cheeky and smart as fuck.
It's a pernicious little fucker, actually, is where I got to with it. I said it in one of my podcasts talking to another cancer friend, Helen. I've said, and bear in mind, we're in the Top Trumps analogy. I've got a very junior version of cancer compared to yours and Helen's, actually, who were both, you had the kind of super Trump. But I have said that I'm a better person for having had cancer. I don't quite say I'm pleased I had it or I'm glad I had it, but I certainly say it's had a net positive influence on my life. But I'm in remission. I've recovered. If I asked you that question, what would your answer be on that?
I think ultimately, I got to a place where I was confident in myself and my beliefs and liking myself, because I was very doubtful of many things, very unsure of so many things before I was diagnosed. And I can confidently say that I like myself and that I like my life. And I think that comes from this constant reminder of my mortality and this constant reminder of who I want to be today and what is it I want from this life that cancer kind of gives you. But I would argue that you don't need to wait till you have cancer to feel that way.
It's so true, isn't it? It is so true. I mean, I've now got three kids, and I try and instill that into them, which is I had an experience which taught me about the transience of life. It taught me about mortality. Mm-hmm. It taught me about how you need to look after yourself physically, but you have to live each day as it's, all the cliches, all the stuff that you read about.
Yeah.
But we've had that experience, and it is a gift to have that experience because you do live your life better. You know that, I know that. You embrace what life offers you and you deal with the shit that cancer... And we are better people for it. And if you can share that as a dad with my three kids and you with your book, which sounds amazing and I can't wait to read it, that is a gift that cancer gives you, but you don't need the cancer to have that gift to share. I mean, I think, honestly, Chris, I think you're a real inspiration. I love your story. You don't need me to tell you this. You know, keep going. Keep being honest. Keep being authentic.
I'll try. I will do my best.
Just tell everyone why they should buy your book plug.
Oh, my God. Do you know what? I haven't even... This is the first time someone's asked me to do that. And I think I'm at the start of the promo for the book. And I literally don't know. You know how you were just talking about Top Trumps and like how, my cancer is stage four, therefore it's more important. But I just don't think it's about that. I think it's like turds come in all sizes and guises and shapes and sizes. I think it's about it's about how you own it and how you experience those things. I once read this quote not long ago, actually, and I used it in my book. It basically says, a traumatic event is only traumatic if it's experienced as such. And I was like, it's how you frame it and how you experience something that matters. It's not like who has the worst illness. It's about what you do with it and how you deal with it. So the book is me sharing everything I've learned from the last 12 years of cancer, how I obviously started the charity and who I was before, like who I was before cancer entered my life and how, like, it's now been in my life for a third of it and what it means to me today and what I've learnt from that. And I think, well, by the end of the book, I think there's a bit of a twist about how I feel towards it.
Wow. I can't wait. When's it out?
19th of August.
Perfect timing. This literally will be a few days after people hear this podcast. So get out there, guys. Buy the book. It's called Glittering a Turd.
Glittering a Turd.
Which I love. It's one of my favourite expressions anyway. Chris, thank you so much for talking to us. You have, your story is amazing. Your dot, dot, dot is amazing. And it will continue to be. Your dot, dot, dot will continue. We'll have to come back and revisit you in a few years. We'll get you back down to the farm to do another Do Lecture. But
oh my gosh,
you are a true inspiration. And I love your honesty and energy. And Chris, thank you so much for talking to us on your dot, dot, dot. And we will talk to you soon. Chris Hallinger, dot,
dot,
dot.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Wow. What a story. Chris is, I found her amazingly inspirational and frankly, unbelievably brave. So I hope you all got as much out of that as I did. As ever, please leave us a review. Please do subscribe. Please tell your friends. And definitely drop me a line, gav@thedolectures.co.uk with any feedback or comments or just say hi. The show was produced by George McDonough. The music was by James Morton. Please do take care and we'll see you again soon. Bye.